The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It's a great honor to be with you in this magnificent library in what must be almost, I have to be loyal to London, my second favorite city in the world. Because it was here that the document I admire almost more than any in the world was written in 1776 by Thomas Jefferson. And it's a great privilege to be here. Friends, I wrote Future Tense about the problems, which are many, that confront the Jewish people in the 21st century. But I think the best introduction I could give to it would be to share with you one of my favorite stories. And here it is. It is set in a rather crowded Jewish restaurant in the Lower East Side in New York on what hot summer's day. It's very crowded, and one of the diners, a rather loud character, summons the waiter and says, "Waiter, it's too hot in here. Turn the air conditioning on." The waiter duly goes out, comes back. 10 minutes later, the same man summons him back and says, "Waiter, it's now too cold in here. Turn the air conditioning off." The waiter goes out a second time. 10 minutes later, he shouts again, "Waiter, it's now too hot again. Turn the air conditioning on." And he's just about to go out for the third time, and a man sitting by the door stops him and says, "Waiter, I feel so sorry for you. That man must be driving you mad." And the waiter says, "Well, no, actually, I'm driving him mad. You see, there is no air conditioning." Sometimes, the climate that we feel is not just out there, but it's in here. And that is what the book is actually about. We know that since the dawn of the new millennium, there has been a marked worsening of the situation of Jews in many parts of the world. Number one, we have seen, certainly in Europe, the return, unbelievably, of anti-Semitism, a mere 60, 65 years after the Holocaust. The unthinkable has happened. Number two, we have seen the increasing isolation of Israel in the international arena and a systematic attempt to delegitimate it. And number three, at the same time, we have seen, sadly, a certain attrition and a loss of numbers within the Jewish people itself. Around the diaspora, wherever you go, something like one in two young Jews are deciding actively or in reality not to marry another Jew, not to build a Jewish home, not to have Jewish children, not to continue the Jewish story. And this is a palpable change from how things were just a half a century ago, when Israel was still at the heights of the memories of the Six-Day War, and when there was an unparalleled integration and acceptance of Jews everywhere else in the world. So those are the changes of the climate out there in the real external world. But what interests me no less is the climate in here. And here I want to tell you a story. It happened 9 years ago, around this time. It was Shavuot, it was May in Jerusalem in 2001. And we were having lunch with a former leader of Diaspora Jewry who'd made Aliyah, with a wonderful Canadian fighter against anti-Semitism. I don't know if you know him or know of him, Owen Kotler, and a former Israeli, an Israeli diplomat. And we were discussing an event in which Owen Kotler and I, in different ways, were very much involved, the notorious United Nations Conference Against Racism in Durban in 2001. I was together with Elie Wiesel, the two Jewish members of the what was called the Special Persons Group, who were advising and so on and so forth, and we knew it was going to be a total disaster. And the diplomat, because we were getting quite miserable, to cheer us up, said, "'Twas ever thus. We are," and here he quoted the famous phrase from Bamidbar, from the Book of Numbers, "we are Am Levadad Yishkon, the people that dwells alone." And all of a sudden, there was a cloud, a burst of light that exploded in my mind. And I said, perhaps too passionately, "What makes you think that was a blessing?" Who said it? Does anyone know who said it? Bilam. And Bilam was not the world's biggest fan of the Jews. Besides which, the Talmud in Tractate Sanhedrin says that all the blessings with which Bilam blessed the Jewish people eventually turned into curses. And thirdly, if you look at the word alone, levadad or levad, in the Bible, it is not a great thing to be. The first time the words not good appear in the Bible are lo tov, heyot adam levado. It is not good for man to be alone. About the leper, it says, badad yeshev mechutz lemachane moshavo, he shall dwell alone outside the camp. In that famous, poignant opening line of Eicha, the Book of Lamentations, Eicha yashva vadad ha'ir rabat yam, how is the city once so full of people desolate and alone? Alone is not a good thing. Maybe Am Levadad Yishkon is not a blessing at all, but a curse. And I said to the ambassador, again, I was being less than diplomatic, but I said, "You know the danger here? If we define ourselves as a people that dwells alone, there's a real risk of that becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy, and we may, God forbid, find ourselves alone. And I think that is bad for Israel, it is bad for the Jews. And if you believe, as I do, that Jews have a contribution to make to the world, then it's bad for the world." And therefore, I thought incessantly about this for the next few years. And I thought about this not just as a detached thinker, because the fact is that my job brought me and brings me daily into the front line of all of these battles. The fight against anti-Semitism, the fight to defend and make Israel's case for it, and of course the challenge of Jewish identity and Jewish continuity. And as I looked at the Jewish world globally, it became more and more clear to me that this negative self-image as the people that dwells alone was leading Jews throughout the world to dysfunctional responses to events, creating among Jews a sense of vulnerability, a sense of fear, a sense of almost paralysis. And therefore, as Jewish communities in the diaspora, one after the other, in Holland, in France, in Germany, in Italy, everywhere, in England, as Jewish communities turned inward, I decided to try and turn them outward. Because I was sure, and I am sure, that this is the only way. And therefore, I'm going to explain what I mean in two instances. These are only two of the book's 11 chapters, but let me explain to you exactly what I mean. First, anti-Semitism. Number one, what's new about the new anti-Semitism? That's something I explain in detail in the book, but let me just share with you very quickly. The new anti-Semitism is not the same as the old, in three significant ways. Number one, as we know, all of you are aware of this, The new anti-Semitism is not directed against Jews as individuals, it is directed against Jews as a nation in their own land. There are, as you know, today in the world more than 100 Christian nations. There are 56 Islamic states. There is one Jewish state. And for many people, that is one too many. And as you know, Israel is enormous. Jews surely don't need that much amount of land. There is a lovely park. I don't know if you've been there in South Africa. You see all the giraffes and the chimps and so on. It's called the Kruger National Park. Have any of you been there? The entire state of Israel is smaller than the Kruger National Park. So here is this tiny country, and we alone among the peoples of the world are not entitled to have a land of our own. I think Amos Oz, the Israeli novelist, put it most poignantly. He said, in the 1930s in Germany, they shouted Jews to Palestine. Now they shout Jews out of Palestine. They don't want us to be here. They don't want us to be there. They don't want us to be. And that is the challenge, number one. Second, the old anti-Semitism, the racial anti-Semitism, was a virus that was created and sustained and carried by national cultures. So you could ask a genuine question. Is France anti-Semitic? Is Austria? Is Poland? Today, it is not carried at all by national cultures. It is carried by the new global media. And those media are very precisely targeted. I'll give you a non-Jewish example. The three suicide bombers who carried out the suicide bombing in the London trains and buses on 7th of July 2005, those three suicide bombers were born in Britain. They lived in Leeds. They were educated in Britain. Their friends, their colleagues, their neighbors had no idea that they carried with them this intense hatred for Britain, which only became revealed by the videos that they left. So this anti-Semitism is very hard to detect. And there can be many cadre of it in the midst of a society that is not anti-Semitic at all. And that is quite different from the old anti-Semitism. And therefore, you can have attacks on Jews in the street, you can have intimidation of Jewish students on campus, and all the rest, even in countries that are absolutely not remotely anti-Semitic. Britain is not remotely anti-Semitic. It is not today, it was in the 1920s, it is not today. But nonetheless, the anti-Semitism that is there in little pockets here and there are very dangerous and very hard to track down. That's the second difference. And the third difference is really painful. It is very hard to legitimate hate. You can't go around telling people in general, go hate X and Y. You need somehow to legitimate it. And therefore, hatred always turns for its justification, for its warrant, to the most prestigious source of authority available in the culture. What was the most prestigious source of authority in the Middle Ages? Religion, exactly. So you had Christian anti-Judaism. It was religious. Could you justify hatred of the Jews on the basis of religion in 19th century, post-Enlightenment, post-emancipation Europe? No way! What was the supreme pristine authority in the 19th century? Science. And so you find racial anti-Semitism predicated on two, they were thought at the time, they were called at the time sciences. They were, of course, pseudosciences. One was the so-called scientific study of race. and the other was called social Darwinism. That just as in nature, the strong eliminate the weak, so in society, the strong nations must eliminate the weak ones. Today, science is no longer the supremely prestigious authority. I don't know what the response has been, because we've been away from home and we haven't been reading the papers, to Craig Venter's little invention of life, artificially created DNA. I don't know. But today, since science has given us the capacity to destroy life on Earth, science is no longer the supreme authority. What is? Pardon? No. Media is the most powerful. I'm talking about the most respected. Pardon? I'll tell you. After the Holocaust, the supreme source of authority became human rights. The United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, etc., etc. We have had, for the last 60 years, a human rights culture. And therefore, today, if you want to mandate hate, you can't do it through science, you can't do it through religion, you do it through human rights. Through human rights NGOs. And that is why, at the Durban conference, 1 week before 9/11, Israel was accused of all five cardinal sins against human rights: racism, apartheid, ethnic cleansing, attempted genocide, crimes against humanity. So these are the three things that make the new anti-Semitism different from the old. So, we have to deal with it. And it's real and it's serious and it's dangerous. However, I had a moment of revelation. I've mentioned one. I'm going to mention another. It took place in Brussels, in the European Union headquarters, in 2003. We had persuaded the Conference of European Rabbis, of which I'm the joint head, together with the European Jewish Congress, we had persuaded Romano Prodi, the head of the European Union at the time, to hold a conference at Brussels in the European Union headquarters on anti-Semitism. We thought it was a major achievement. Get Europe to study anti-Semitism. To my horror, shock, when I arrived and I looked around the hall, at least 95, possibly 98% of the people there were Jewish. Now, I have a problem with this. In the 1960s, the great scholar of Jewish mysticism, Gershom Scholem, made Aliyah, left Germany in the 1920s. In the 1960s, Gershom Scholem was invited back to Germany to take part in a conference on... The title of the conference was The German-Jewish Dialogue. He declined. He refused. And he wrote a letter saying why. He said there was no German-Jewish dialogue. For 150 years, Jews spoke to Germans. But the Germans weren't listening. And these are Scholem's words. To whom then were the Jews talking? The answer, to themselves. And whenever I find Jews talking to themselves, I realize we're in a difficult situation. And therefore, I got up at that conference and I said these words, which I have since repeated, and they have been actually pronounced in public, first by Tony Blair, then by Gordon Brown, then by David Cameron. These were the words. Jews cannot fight anti-Semitism alone. The victim cannot cure the crime. The hated cannot cure the hate. I will stand up, as I said at the time in Brussels, for the right of Christians to live anywhere in the world without fear. But you Christians must stand up for the right of Jews to live without fear. I help lead the campaign in Britain, I said. and this is true, from 2002 onwards, against Islamophobia. But I need you Muslims to lead the campaign against Judeophobia. And the result has been that Britain became the first country in which the fight against anti-Semitism is led by non-Jews. Led by the all-party parliamentary committee on anti-Semitism, which monitors it constantly and delivers an annual report, by the interdepartmental government committee that deals with all aspects of anti-Semitism as it impacts on any area of government policy, both of those bodies in regular and constant liaison with the Jewish community. And let me give you a simple example of the difference it makes. We had a few years ago a mayor of London who was not known for his great love of Israel or the Jews. I won't mention names. Who invited an imam of the kind that you wouldn't necessarily invite for Kiddush. So this happened twice. The first time, the Jewish community of Britain protested. It made zero difference. He didn't bother even to reply. The imam came, and that was it. It was a very bad moment for the Jewish community. The next time he invited the same imam, this time the people who protested were a coalition of Jews, of Hindus, of Sikhs, of moderate Muslims, of gays, and of women's rights activists. The mayor of London backed down without a word. That is the difference it makes when you try to fight anti-Semitism alone and when you go in with allies. Never define yourself as the people that dwells alone. That's anti-Semitism. Now, let us deal with the other challenge, the other great challenge, Jewish continuity, Jewish identity, the internal strength of the Jewish community. As you know, something happened in the second half of the 1980s, and it happened first here in America. You remember the famous 1991 National Jewish Population Survey, that showed that of young Jews who had got married between 1985 and 1990, 57% had been out marriages. Now, there was and that was, I think, serious. The Jewish people has been disappearing faster than any other group since the Lost Ten Tribes. Of course, the Lost Ten Tribes weren't really lost. They came to Britain, I'm sure you know that. British means man of the covenant, and etc. But anyway, it is true that there were other times when Jews left the faith. 15th century Spain was one. 19th century Eastern Europe was another. But those were ages of intense anti-Semitism. In the second half of the 1980s, there was no anti-Semitism at all here, at least lower than it has ever been in history. So what happened all of a sudden? Now, the answers to that question are complex. But one factor surely was this. The generation that came of age between 1985 and 1990 were the generation born around or shortly after the Eichmann trial in 1961. You know that for the first 13 years after, the first 16 years after the Holocaust, very little was said about it, very little was heard about it, especially in Israel. It was the Eichmann trial that suddenly broke through the dam of pent-up feelings, and there was a flood of Holocaust museums, Holocaust exhibitions, Holocaust memorials, conferences, university courses, and books. There was a time in America when one in every four books published on a Jewish theme was about the Holocaust. And that generation, brought up against that background, decided to marry out at the rate of 57%. Why? Because if Jews are victims, do you want your children to be victims? If Jews suffered, you want your children to suffer. If Jews are the people destined to dwell alone, do you want your grandchildren to have to live alone? No way. It was none other than one of the pioneer Holocaust historians, the late Lucy Davidovits, who towards the end of her life wondered if this movement that she had started had just gone too far. And this is what she said. If we carry on like this, our young people will grow up knowing about the Greeks and how they lived, about the Romans and how they lived, about the Jews and how they died. And the result is Jews for a generation didn't want to identify very positively as Jews at all. It was the late, wonderful Shlomo Kalbach of blessed memory who spent a lifetime going around universities. And he used to say this. He said, I go around students of every kind and I ask them what they are. And if somebody gets up and says, I'm a Catholic, I know that's a Catholic. And if somebody gets up and says, I'm a Protestant, I know that's a Protestant. And if somebody gets up and says, I'm just a human being, I know that's a Jew. And this is tragic. At some point in our recent history, we changed our definition of ourselves from the people loved by God into the people hated by Gentiles. That's a bad substitution. There's no way out of that. Well, luckily, we were a few years behind the States. We usually are in Europe. And this meant that outmarriage had not reached those proportions by then in British Jewry. I was appointed chief rabbi in 1990. I became chief rabbi in 1991. And in 1993, after 3 years of thinking about this problem nonstop, I launched a program called Jewish Continuity. And it was based on the following analysis. Having read all the literature, I came to the conclusion that the only thing strong enough to make intensify Jewish identity was Jewish education, serious Jewish education, Jewish day schools. However, I knew the fact that every chief rabbi since 1845, there haven't been many of us because, as somebody once asked the late chief rabbi J.H. Hertz, how long do chief rabbis serve? And he replied, chief rabbis never retire and only very rarely die. So all my predecessors tried to tell people build Jewish day schools and none of them really succeeded. So I realized I had to get Jews to build Jewish day schools, but I realized I really couldn't put it that way. So I decided to eventually to go at it a different way completely. And I launched a campaign around one question. The title of the book I eventually published on that subject. The question was, will we have Jewish grandchildren? And we did it all sorts of ways, but the single decisive moment came when we decided to hire a young, very energetic and imaginative advertising team, and they designed an advert for us. We took it out as a full page in the Jewish press. That one advert changed the history of British Jewry. It showed a group of nice young Jewish men and women, exactly as you would like to be, or your children to be, or your grandchildren to be. Shana Mela, nice young men. And they're walking along a floor and falling one after the other into the abyss. And the headline read, Anglo-Jewry has been losing 10 Jews a day, every day, for the last 40 years. That sent ripples around our community like nothing before or since. Now, what was the result 17 years on? In 1993, 25% of young Jews in Britain went to a Jewish day school. Today, 65% and rising. We have built more day schools in the last 17 years than in the entire previous 3.5 centuries of British Jewish history. Now, what difference did that make? It's interesting. For 60 years, from 1945 to 2005, year on year, without exception, Anglo-Jewry suffered demographic decline. From 2005 to today, it's been growing. Not fast, but it's been growing. The numbers of synagogue marriages has been rising year by year. The number of Jewish births has been rising year by year. And the number of Jewish deaths has been declining year on year. Why that? I'm not sure. Although maybe more Yiddishkeit is good for you. In America, they did a survey which showed if you go regularly to a house of worship, your life expectancy, you live 7 years longer. Or as I said to Elaine, maybe it just feels like 7 years longer. But there it is. We actually turned it around. Now, I'm not saying all this was due to our organization, Jewish Continuity. A great deal is due to the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox community, which has really been the one really growing section of our community. But nonetheless, to be able to reverse a trend that every sociologist had seen as irreversible, that was not bad going. But, of course, that was only part of the strategy. To create a scare, will we have Jewish grandchildren, is only part of the strategy. And therefore, I made the decision at the same time to do what Jews have traditionally been a little reluctant to do. I decided to take our faith into the public domain. And so I decided not just to speak to Jews, but to the British public as a whole. And so I did, and still do, a great deal of broadcasting for the BBC on both radio and television. I write a regular column for the Times. 7 of my books have been serialized in the national press, not the Jewish press. And I am, I think, as well known among non-Jews as among Jews. I do much better with the non-Jews than Jews. That goes without saying. But at any rate, what I was trying to say to the community was, instead of turning inward, let's turn outward. Let's share our faith. Let's work with others. Let us not be the people that dwells alone. And what do I talk about on the Beeb or whatever? I don't talk about anti-Semitism. I don't talk about Israel. I talk about Jewish ethics. I talk about spirituality. I talk about wisdom. I talk about love, for heaven's sake. I have a profound conviction, which I share with you. There is one fundamental difference between material goods and spiritual goods. The fundamental material goods, as we know, are wealth and power, economics and politics, the market and the state. Let me do a very simple thought experiment with you. Supposing I have $10,000 and decide to share it with 9 other people, how much do I get left with? 1/10 of what I had before. Supposing I have total power, like the Shul president in Britain who used to say, all those who agree say aye, all those who disagree say I resign. Now, suppose I have total power and decide to share it with 9 others, how much power do I have left? 1/10 of what I began with. Now, supposing we don't deal with wealth and power, but think about something like love or friendship or influence. Supposing I decide to share that with 9 others, how much do I have left? Less? The same? More. Now go figure. That's the difference between physical goods and spiritual goods. Physical goods work by division. Spiritual goods work by multiplication. Or, to put it in games theory terms, material goods are zero-sum games. Spiritual goods are non-zero. And therefore, the more we share with others, the more we will have ourselves. And therefore, Judaism is about the love we share. The love we share with God. The love we share with our neighbor. The love we share with the stranger. That's what Judaism is about. It's about tzedek, love as justice. It's about chesed, love as kindness. The love we enact every time we do a mitzvah, every time we do a good or a holy deed. And the result is that when we share our faith with others, we begin to recover a sense of positive identity. We're no longer the people that dwell alone. And I hope I have shown, therefore, that in these two examples, and I deal with the others in the book, in the case of anti-Semitism and about Jewish continuity, the worst strategy is to define ourselves as the people who dwell alone. And the best strategy is to go out and engage with the world. And the truth is that, yes, the Jewish people has many enemies. But we also have many friends. And we would have more the more we try to win them. And so, at the end of Future Tense, I explain the double entendre of my title. Yes, the future is going to be tense. But also, in a quite different sense, Judaism is the religion of the future tense. The only religion in which God defines himself when Moses says, "Who are you?" as "Eheyeh, Asher Eheyeh." I will be what I will be. We are the only culture whose golden age is in the future. We are the people who, in answer to the question, "Has the Messiah come?" answer, "Not yet." We are the people of the future tense. And that is why I define Jews and Judaism as the religion of hope. The hope you find in the Bible. The hope you find in the prophets. That ridiculous, absurd, but world-transforming hope. Though even slaves can one day go free, even though they never forget the taste of matzah and marah. That crazy hope that right can eventually defeat might. That crazy Jewish hope that we can build a society based on justice and compassion. That crazy hope that says, in the face of any fear, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. And therefore, I define at the end of the book Judaism not as the people that dwells alone, but Judaism is the voice of hope in the conversation of humankind. That is my vision of the future. I hope you'll share with me in making it real. Thank you. Now, I was going to say that I will now take questions, but I was told in Philadelphia that you don't need to tell an audience to ask questions. So please raise your hand and please wait till a microphone is brought to you. Yeah.
I think one of the problems that you touched on, and that is Jews marrying out, young Jews marrying out, I think you can look at it another way, and it comes closer to the real problem. I married a Gentile woman, but I didn't marry out. She married in. And if you look at it that way, the problem becomes, how do you take people who marry in, and they marry in because they admire Judaism? You said that it all started in 1961 when the Holocaust horrors were revealed. Well, Jews became also glorified at that time because they were survivors. Israel was thriving. It was an exciting place. And people, Gentiles, wanted in. But there was no way, there's no policies, there's no system of really bringing in Gentile people who want in and really are great admirers of Judaism. And that, to me, yeah. is the problem.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, just a little, just a few days ago, as we celebrated the festival of Shavuot, we read of one of the really great non-Jewish women who did join the Jewish people, Ruth. And Ruth, who said, "Your people will become my people and your God my God," was not a minor figure in Jewish history. She was the great-grandmother of Israel's greatest king, King David, the greatest religious poet the world has ever known. And what non-Jews have brought to Judaism through adopting it and becoming part of the Jewish people is absolutely immense. You may find this unusual, but when I first went to yeshiva, a very Hasidic yeshiva in Israel, my teacher, who was a Chassid with a long beard and a great Talmudist, himself was a convert who had been drawn to Judaism. Perhaps, who knows, because he had a Jewish girlfriend. So I can never cease to admire and be inspired by those who come within from outside. So I share your feelings very much so. I know we don't make it easy, but then Jews never make anything easy. But I am moved by your story, and I share your feelings. Yeah.
Rabbi Sachs, how does denominational difference factor into your program, your vision?
Well, denominational difference, in other words, you know, if we can reach out the hand of friendship to Christians, Sikhs, Hindus, moderate Muslims, how come we can't hold out the hand of friendship between Orthodox, Conservative, Reform Jews? And that's a very good question. So let me tell you how after some... It is a very difficult problem, and we had problems in Britain. In the early years of my chief rabbinate, we didn't know how to slice this. And eventually I came up with a formula which worked and works and has integrity. And here it is. On all matters that affect us as Jews, regardless of our religious differences, we will work together, regardless of our religious differences. And on all matters that touch on our religious differences, we will agree to differ, but with respect. And so I, as an Orthodox rabbi, work with conservative and reform and liberal, what you would call Reconstructionist rabbis, on interfaith, on fighting anti-Semitism, on welfare, on Israel experience and advocacy. We work together across the board on all of these things. Holocaust remembrance. Because they affect us as Jews regardless of our religious differences. And on the matters that touch on our religious differences, namely synagogue life, we agree to differ but with respect. And the leaders of those movements are personal friends of Elaine and myself. We meet quietly together often. Whenever we don't meet, you know, we see what happens because denominational differences can easily spin out of control. And so we have developed the situation of mutual respect, personal friendship, and that principled approach to Jewish difference, which allows us to overcome those difficult divisions.
Okay.
Yeah.
One of your premises tonight was the importance of not being a people alone, and yet you also referenced the growth of the Haredi community in England, a community that generally chooses to be a community alone. How do you reconcile that?
Well, I will tell you. This book is a challenging book because today the most successful growing movement in the Jewish world are those Jews who have disengaged from the world. And therefore, I am making the argument for Jews who engage with the world. Because if I don't, then in 50 years' time, all that will be left will be Haredim. In 50 years' time, 3 in every 4 children born in the state of Israel will be either Palestinian or Haredi. That is, the two groups that do not recognize the state of Israel. 75%. That is not a bull, that is not a speculative figure. That is an official government prediction or an official think tank prediction. I don't want to say what's going to happen here in the United States, but you can do the arithmetic, okay? And therefore, the question is, who will give us a compelling alternative? And that's what I'm trying to do in this book. I'm trying to say, as an Orthodox Jew, in which the whole of Orthodoxy is going that way, I'm trying to say, no, I'm trying to say there is another way. And if we have real courage of our convictions, we can go out there and not lose our identity. And so I have done, and so I have experienced. As I tell my guys in Britain, this may not make the same sense to you in America, because America is different and American Jewry is different. But what I tell people in Britain, and when I say this, everyone nods their head, non-Jews respect Jews who respect Judaism. Non-Jews are embarrassed by Jews who are embarrassed by Judaism. So I'm saying you can go there, out there into the world and walk tall. And that is my alternative. I'm showing that there is an alternative. If we come to the conclusion that the only way we can survive as Jews in the 21st century is by cutting ourselves off from contact, not only with the wider world, but with our own fellow Jewish brothers and sisters who happen to not eat gluck kosher or wear Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin. If the only way we can live is behind those high defensive walls of an imaginary ghetto that we thought we left 200 years ago, then I have to say this is not the religion I believe in. I respect the Haredim, but I do not abdicate responsibility for showing there is another way. Lady there.
I'm glad to see you're looking well. I remember when you were here to address the Philadelphia Greater Board of Rabbis. So it's a pleasure for my husband and me to see you. At any rate, my question is specifically in the implementation of the continuity program in Great Britain vis-a-vis curriculum. I am so interested that, at least in the religious schools I've been a part of, gosh, even in the one I directed, during my seminary studies, I realized that the largest line item budget in the education program was always Holocaust connected, and the way that Israel was pitched was essentially under the aegis of Holocaust corrective, you know exactly what I mean, where the greatest assembly with a lot of energy to shushes, yellow candles, 6 in number are lit, was the only time that the grandparents showed up. Horrific. Thank God children knew. Walk out, don't pay attention, put my MP3 player on. I don't want to be part of a program where the reward is my empty shoes are in a pile in a museum somewhere. So I'm really curious how in particular your educational program addresses this issue in light of children who we want to unfurl the future of our scroll.
Yeah, we don't go in for any of that whatsoever. And we have brought all our schools together, all the schools other than the Haredi schools, under a collective curriculum development project. Let me explain. I started an organization in 93 called Jewish Continuity. I believe in starting things and giving them away. And then I can start something new. That's what I do with all my best ideas. If they're good ideas, I can give them away and they will survive and thrive. So 3 years later, in 96, I gave Jewish Continuity to the organization called JIA, or what you would call UJA. And it then became UJIA, Rescue and Renewal. Rescue vis-a-vis Israel, Renewal vis-a-vis British Jewry, and the two were dovetailed, so we made a connection between British Jewish kids and the bit of Israel that we were redeveloping, namely the Galil. So the kids from the Galil come and spend time with British families, British kids go and spend time with kids in the Galil. So we, so if you get in touch with our UJIA, they will put you in touch with our whole curriculum development project. Until then, all of our Jewish day schools were, you know, making shabbos for themselves alone, as they used to say. They were all doing their own thing. And now we've brought them together, and they're all working together on curriculum development. That's number one. Number two, for the last 2 years, I have been developing a shul-based Yom HaShoah ceremony. Because I realized that as the survivors are getting older and fewer, we haven't yet developed a Yom HaShoah ceremony like, let us say, Choral Slichot, or like Tisha B'Av. And I've begun to develop a shul-based ceremony, which we have now done twice, and I am now going to globalize it by making a film based on it and putting it on the web and offering it to every shul and school in the world. And the essence of it is that this is a future-looking, child-oriented ceremony called From Grief to Hope. And that is a way of taking all that pain and transforming it into positive world-building, life-affirming elements. And as for Israel, I'm saying, guys, don't see Israel as the city of refuge of the Jewish people. Don't think of it in Holocaust terms. Think of it as the only place in 4,000 years that Jews have ever been able to do what we knew and know we were called on to do in the first place, build a society according to our values. Now, I think Israel still has a little way to go, to be honest with you. But at least that's how we portray Israel. We send a higher proportion of our kids for serious study time in Israel than any other country in the world. They do it as part of school. They do it as gap year. We get as many kids as we can. In London, North London, 80% of British Jewish kids spend at least a month and hopefully a year in Israel. Of course, many of them make Aliyah, but that's okay. And that's how we do it. So, and if you want a way of talking about Israel in a really positive, non-Holocaust way, I actually spent 9 months developing a program to tell young kids, recapture for young kids, the emotional drama that people had who lived through 48 or that I had in 67. And it's called Home of Hope. It's a double CD. You can actually download it if you key in Home of Hope into Google. It takes forever. I haven't worked out how to use it yet. But if you want a copy, we'll send it to you. And if you haven't got time to listen to 22 audio spoken tracks and 24 music tracks, 7 of which we specially produced, and you only have 4 minutes, please key in to YouTube, and see the little video that we did to make people think positively about Israel. It's called Oseh Shalom. Just type in O-S-E-H Shalom, and you'll see that when I last looked, 897,000 people had clicked on this website, and you will be able to read 74 pages of young Jews around the world saying in different words, Israel, I love you. Yeah.
Rabbi Sacks, it's always a pleasure to hear you, and I feel very good that this is not my first time. But my question is this. How do you extend love in the face of persistent rejection, particularly on the international scene?
Explain the question, please.
I mean that people don't like the Jews. I think your analysis is extremely compelling, but various in international settings, at least as reported in the press, people often walk out when the Jewish, especially representative, any Jewish representative from Israel comes. Britain, I understand the situation has been modified, but Britain has, made announcements that they are ready to arrest any of the leaders of Israel if they ever show up. I mean, how?
No. Sorry.
That's
not entirely true. What exists in Britain, and we have to get removed as quickly as possible. We couldn't do it because a general election intervened. Be aware that I personally spoke to Gordon Brown about this. He was absolutely personally committed. He wrote an article in the national press saying he was absolutely committed to the abolition of this law. And, of course, now that he's no longer prime minister, we have to sit down with the new prime minister, which we will do. I spoke to him and to Nick Clegg already last week, and as soon as we can, we'll get that abolished. It's got nothing to do with Israel. It is a universal right of any citizen to claim the privilege of a citizen's arrest under international human rights law. And it is the point that I've made to you, that the main problem today is not coming from religion, it's not coming from science, it's coming from human rights legislation. And we have to address this, which is why I so admire Professor Erwin Kotler of Canada, former president of the Canadian Board of Deputies, former justice minister of the Canadian government. And we're going to sit down seriously with the government to deal with human rights legislation. But again, I am not going to do this on my own. Before the general election, I sat with the Archbishop of Canterbury and the 26 Church of England bishops who sit in the House of Lords, and I spoke with Vincent Nichols, the head of the Catholic Church, and we are agreed that all three of us are going to go together to the government to get human rights legislation changed. So this, I mean, just be aware that all the stuff you read on emails, just be aware emails are the greatest promoter of paranoia since the Jews. So, but as I say, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean I don't have enemies. And what I am telling you is that if you spend 10 years telling yourself the world hates us, you will not go out there and win friends. You won't even know how to do it. And I am telling you that do not represent any general movement of opinion. I don't. I'm an oddball. I am going against the trend. And I am saying, guys, I don't agree with you. I do not believe that anti-Semitism is somehow written into the DNA of the human genome. I do not feel it's an inexorable fate. I know that some rabbi said, why was Mount Sinai called Mount Sinai? Because Misham Yatza Sinah La'olam. Because from there, hatred went out into the world. I've got to tell you, some people don't like Jews, and some Jews don't like Jews. But I am still not willing to accept defeat. I am not a fatalist. Or as Isaac Bashevis Singer said, we have to believe in free will. We have no choice. So what you say is true, but it is the result of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah.
I've heard something a little different, and I wonder if you've heard about it too, that there are a lot of young Christians in Germany and Poland who've become extremely interested in Judaism, and they've been studying it and learning about it, and it's, you know, these are young people in their 20s and their teens. It's just something that they're interested in. And I've heard this from other young people who have traveled to, Jewish young people who have traveled to those countries and have witnessed this. So have you heard anything about that?
I haven't, and I'm very interested in what you have to say. But I do believe that if you go out and extend a hand of friendship to committed Christians, many of them are deeply moved. In 2008, I became the first rabbi in history to address a plenary session of the Lambeth Conference. That's the conference that meets every 10 years in Canterbury. All the Anglican bishops from around the world, all 750 of them and their wives, to invite a rabbi to give them a shiur for an hour. It's on our website. Although it begins with the joke I told this evening, I don't tell it too often, only to very special friends, but go and see it on our website. The Jesuits just gave me an honorary doctorate in Britain. Princeton Theological Seminary just awarded me last month the Abraham Kuyper Prize for original contributions to Calvinist theology. Not a lot of rabbonim did that. So if you reach out the hand of friendship, it is reciprocated. And if Christians in Germany and Austria are developing positive attitudes to Jews, why shouldn't we reciprocate? For heaven's sake, we are not the people that dwell elsewhere. And Christians who think the matter through know that they got their faith from Avraham Avinu. They are children of Abraham like us. The founder of their faith was a Jew. Born a Jew, died a Jew. And therefore, I take all of these things as a sign of hope. And yes, there is still a set of residual problems between some branches of Christianity and Jews. But when I wrote another book of mine called Dignity of Difference, and the Archbishop of Canterbury reviewed it in the Jewish Chronicle, now that's a first. And the head of the Catholic Church in Britain ordered all his bishops to read it. And the head of the World Dominican Order, Father Timothy Radcliffe, you know, the Dominicans were the ones in the Middle Ages who conducted the book burnings and the public disputations. When Timothy Radcliffe, head of the World Dominican Order in 2003, said to me, wrote to me from saying, Chief Rabbi, for the next year, wherever I go, I am going to teach your book. These were moments of profound reconciliation and healing. And they, I hope, go to vindicate the argument I've made tonight. Friends, I think this has to be the last question, and I leave it to you to choose the last question because they'll never forgive me.
So thank you so much, Rabbi, for coming tonight. Just to give you a little bit of insight, there's a lot of stuff going on in Poland. In fact, by this woman sitting in front of me doing a lot of stuff as far as Poland reconciliation with Jews. But
bless you.
The actual question I have for you is dealing with Jews that are my age and a whole bunch of people that came tonight. There's really a fight amongst Jews, Jewish youth, that is either you become apathetic, as you were saying, and becoming assimilated, or you are in this world of alarmism and anti-Semitism is going to kill you. or Israel is going to be destroyed unless you do absolutely everything in your power to do it, to stop it. And so my question to you is, how do you get Jews, how do you get Jews to re-engage in Judaism, where on a daily basis, forgetting about Shabbat, but just caring more about Judaism than I'm too busy, I'm going to go party, or too busy, it's not important to me, to actually start caring about Judaism, while at the same time you also have Jews that care about Judaism but are saying, from the emails that even I get, I'm like laughing at the paranoia. But what would you say is a message for young Jews that we can, as the future, teach both to the older generations and to the newer generations about keeping Judaism alive and keeping those two sides at bay?
Number one, let me tell you a story that happened a few months ago. You know a little bit of this story. I'm going to tell you another bit of this story. A friend of mine, a very frum guy, learns Daf Yomi, learns every day, has a son in an Israeli yeshiva, and he, an international businessman, flies out every month to spend a day learning with his son in yeshiva. Now, this man, this very frum Jew, gave one of his children the most remarkable bar mitzvah present I ever came across. He's a very, very successful businessman, rich guy. And the bar mitzvah present he gave his son was that he took his son, this is another son, he took his son and went for a week, the two of them, to live in a Romanian orphanage. That was the bar mitzvah present. That his child should know that not everyone is rich. Not everyone has it as easy as that child has. And when they came home after that week, his son said, "Dad, you know, when I grow up, do you think I'll be able to help them the way you help them?" Now, this same Jew, who is involved actually also not only in Israeli things and European things, also is involved with a wonderful American Jewish organization called The Joint, the JDC. And as a result, you know, I don't know where he was, he's always traveling the world, and he heard about the earthquake in Haiti. And through contacts with The Joint, he was able to fly straight there to the disaster zone, where no one else was getting in. I mean, the Israeli field medical team was getting in, and Zaka, you know, who happened to be doing some stuff in Mexico nearby, and they were the first on the scene. But he, and those stories you picked up on CNN, so you'll know about them. But I'm telling you a story you don't know about. He landed there in the tent city among the survivors in Port-au-Prince and discovered that there was no shortage of food, but there was no drinking water. And he realized that this was the real immediate crisis. Being a Mache, you know, and knowing a few, he found the nearest water purification plant 15 miles away, hired a lorry with a 3,000-gallon tank, and drove, collected 3,000 gallons, brought to them to the center of the refugees, and was able to provide water for 3,000 people. It was clear to him immediately that this was nothing, a drop in the bucket, you know. And he didn't know what to do. And so he told me, I mean, this is how I know, because he told me the story. Eventually, as it happens, I told a bit of the story on the BBC so that 5 million Brits now know about it, because I didn't want this just to be entrepreneur. Having asked his permission, I hastened to add, he just decided to do something he'd never done before, and since I'm from the Jurassic age, I've certainly never done before. he decided to blog. Started doing a blog telling people what the facts were on the ground. Within 4 days, he had 200 people sponsoring lorries with gallons. And by the time he left, he was providing, 5 days later, he was providing water for 100,000 people in Haiti. Just so that they should be aware that, you know, there's an issue here. He planted by every tank of water an Israeli flag, even though he's not an Israeli. And I thought that was a pretty good piece of PR. Now, there's a guy who learns Gemara every single day, a frum guy, who, to me, is living Judaism, not just mouthing it. And the challenge I give to you and your friends and your generation is go out there and live it. Judaism is serious. It's not a matter of living in Borough Park or wearing a Borsellino hat. It's a matter of taking this world and changing it. L'shem Shamayim. And out of love for God and humanity, go out there and lead, and you will find that your contemporaries will follow because they recognize this is who we are. Laila Tov.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.